You're very welcome back to the programme. Joining me tonight to discuss the National Service Plan, which was finally published today by the Health Service Executive, are Gerry Buttermer, Fine Gael Chairman of the Oireachtas Health Committee, Michael O'Keefe, Consultant Ophthalmologist at the Mater and Temple Street Hospitals, Monaghan-based GP Dr Ilona Duffy, who has travelled from there to be with us tonight despite the awful weather. So thank you for that, Ilona. And we're also joined by health journalist and writer Priscilla Lynch. So the plan for how the health service will operate next year was finally published today. The cuts needed are vast, €619 million, in addition to a deficit of around €400 million going into next year. There's been a lot of focus on the drastic reduction in the amount to be saved from cutting people's medical cards. The budget in October had allocated €113 million. It's now €23 million. There's also unspecified pay savings of €108 million. Well, as soon as his news briefing was finished, the Director General of the HSE, Tony O'Brien, came into RTE to be interviewed by Sean O'Rourke, who began by asking him how 666 had become 619.
Well, on Budget Day, the government announced measures which then total €666 million. They now total €619. And some of those measures, for example, are the full year impact of changes that were made last year. So, for example, the 2014 effect of the agreement that was made with the drugs industry will provide us with €28 million in cost reduction. The introduction of reference pricing, which we started following legislation on the 1st of November, will benefit us to the tune of €50 million next year, and it will also benefit those who pay privately for their medications. The Haddington Road Agreement is very important and will enable us to change the cost base of the way we provide our services, both by additional flexibility and extra hours. And that will be very important when it comes to reconfiguring hospital services and community services. So there are a range of choices like that. The controversial measure, which was a medical card probity measure valued at £113 million, has now been dropped. We will still do medical card probity as we must. We had originally ourselves proposed £20 million, and that now stands at £23 million.
So how do you explain the imposition of this figure, which you never agreed with, of £113 million on Budget Day?
Well, I think government has agreed by changing the decision that it's better not to do that. So essentially we have one decision for £130 million, which came with a process of validation and verification, at the end of which government has made a subsequent decision, which we very much welcome.
But the original figure was never for real, and it raises questions about the entire budgeting process, surely, if they can literally pluck a figure out of the air, and that seems to be what happened, well, and put it in there to make the numbers add up. It's not so much funny money as voodoo economics.
Well, I can't really comment on the process because obviously I'm not part of government. But what I can say is that 113 could not have been achieved through probity measures. It would have necessitated changes which would have rendered some people...
In other words, it was never for real, is what you're saying.
Well, it couldn't be delivered. I think everyone agrees that it couldn't be delivered, and that's why it's now effectively disappeared.
The other provision, and it's a substantial amount of money, £37 million has been provided for medical cards for children aged 5 or under, £37 million. But there's no agreement with doctors. So is that figure plucked from the air?
No, I think that figure is something that's realistic, and we believe it's sufficient to pay for that service. A number of things have to happen. Firstly, there has to be legislation to provide a legal basis for providing those GP visit cards for everyone aged 5 and under. And then obviously a process of agreement with service providers has to be completed. But the funding, I wouldn't have any concerns that the funding is appropriate.
Coming back to other figures, again, there's a big allocation there of something in the order of 200 and odd million euro in savings under the Haddington Road on pay. But 108 million of that is not specified. That's held back to central headquarters of the HSE. Again, this is a bit like, or it seems on the face of it to be a bit like, you know, expecting to save 113 million from probity and medical cards. Nobody expects it to happen.
Well, the first thing to say is that the Haddington Road Agreement is, as I said earlier, very important to how we'll achieve what we need to do next year. 140 million of the figures for next year is core to Haddington Road. It's essentially building upon what's been done in 2013. There's 108 that's in an unspecified category, simply meaning that we're going through a further process with our colleagues in both the Department of Health, the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, to satisfy ourselves about that.
What that really means, Tony, is that you've gone through Haddington Road. You've had it for over 6 months. You were allocated a certain amount of savings to provide under Haddington Road, which is out of proportion to the number of people in the public service made up by people working in the HSE. The most you could find was 140, and yet you've been saddled with 108, and you haven't found out yet where it's coming from.
Well, what we have is an agreed process, and that relates to the 108 and also to the remaining part of the 113 figure for medical card probity, which is left over once we've received an additional sum of 47 million through the revised estimate. So both of those two things need further examination.
That was the Director General of the HSE, Tony O'Brien, talking to Sean O'Rourke this morning. Ilona Duffy, Dr. Ilona Duffy, you've seen this plan, you've read it. Is it a good plan?
Absolutely not. I think this is another plan, and it's another plan showing more cuts and more pain for patients. And I think we've just heard the issue of the medical cards, I think, is the one that's still the most shocking for all of us. I mean, nobody seems to know what's going on. We're talking about making cuts in the medical card section, cutting medical cards from vulnerable people. And it's important to remember the medical card scheme is based on a means-tested scheme where people who are the poorest and generally those with the most medical problems are meant to be entitled to free healthcare.
Well, he was very clear on that this morning in his interview with Sean. He said that if people's situations, their entitlements, their eligibility doesn't change, if their circumstances don't change, their medical card will not be taken away, will not be affected in any way.
Well, that's what we're being told, but actually that's not what's happening on the ground. We're seeing patients who are getting letters to say their medical card has been cancelled for no reason. They have cards that tell them they have a date of 2 years from now with an expected expiry date on it, and suddenly they're told no medical card. They're sent forms telling them to send in all their details again for reviews. They do that and they expect that they'll get that medical card back immediately, and they don't. And months go by where people with chronic care needs just can't access medicines, they can't access doctors, and this is unacceptable. And again, we're being told the whole time nothing's changing, anyone who needs a medical card will have a medical card. How are we going to get these cuts in the medical card section if it's not by taking from those who have them, and the people who have them are the people who need them?
But it's drastically reduced. You would appreciate that, you would acknowledge that.
It's drastically reduced because I think, you know, the people on the ground have been marching, have been ringing Joe Duffy, have been out there telling their TDs, I'm going to die if I don't get my medical card back. And that was the reality of it. People with diabetes, people with asthma were saying, we can't afford to buy our inhalers. We're doing without them. We're going to end up in casualty. We're going to end up suffering as a result of this. And I think it's only because of that backlash that we're seeing this change in process.
Jerry Buttermer, what do you say to that, that this medical cards thing is still a fiasco?
Well, first of all, I want to welcome the publication of the report. We're still spending 13.2 billion almost on health as a country. This government is committed to ensuring that we have reform of our health service, that we cut the cost of delivery of service rather than the quality or the continuum of care. And where I disagree with Ilona in the context of medical cards is we have 1.8 million of our population with a medical card. It's up 40% since 2008, 850,000 people. Now, let's have a debate and a philosophical debate on what we want to do with medical cards. And maybe it's about time that we parked the play acting and the grandstanding in terms of medical cards. The people who are entitled to medical cards are getting them. What we had in the past, whether we like it or not, was we had a system of patronage where we had people going into deciding offices across the 32 counties of Ireland, or 26 in our case now, the four provinces, and there was no uniformity of standard or application. And people who were 400% and 500%, as you will agree, got medical cards. And what we must do now is to ensure, and what I want to do as a Fine Gael public representative and as a caring person, is that those who are entitled to and those who should get retain and hold them. But can you justify, in many cases, a person 400 and 500% over the income levels receiving a medical card? I can't do that, and I won't do that. But what I will do is I will drive reform of a healthcare system which allows the person who is the most vulnerable, who is the sickest, who needs that access to service and treatment to get the medical card, because they deserve it and they should have it and they should never have it taken away from them. And I'll accept there was mistakes made and people did fall through the cracks in the context of the centralisation of the medical card. But let's make it clear, there is a distinction we must draw between probity and eligibility. And the Healthcare Act of 1970 is on, as you say, financial means, and there is a discretionary basis there, okay, which the HSE do use and do have the discretion, as we said, to give it. But what I want to say is there must be fairness and equity in the system, and I accept that fully.
Ilona Duffy.
Okay, Jerry, I think it's easy to pick numbers out of the air and say that there were people getting discretionary cards who shouldn't have had.
But there is.
But, Jerry, there are a couple of things here. The majority of people who are getting medical cards who are those who cannot afford not to have a medical card. They're people who are on welfare benefits of some sort or another. They're on people who are on below minimum wage if they are even working. And those who are working are probably losing are actually losing their medical cards.
But can I ask you one question?
Come back to this.
Could I ask you one question?
Hang on for one second, because I think it's important. You've talked about making sure those who deserve the cards get them, and that those who are hundreds over the, let's say, the criteria per week for being allowed a medical card don't, and yet you're about to hand out free medical cards to all children who are age 5 and under, whereas in fact this is nothing but a vote-catching ploy, and what we should be doing is saying we'll use that money to give it to more vulnerable people to make sure they're in the loop for getting a medical card, the people who actually need it.
And we've included 35 million extra for 60,000 medical cards issued. But can I ask you a question? Since 2008, we've seen an increase of 590,000 people with medical cards. 40% of the population.
And we've also seen an increase in those who are on the dole, yeah, those who are out of work, or those who are in mortgage arrears. Those, they're only getting the cards because they can't afford not to have
the
card.
But the point they're making is those who need it are getting it. And I accept the point. There are people who fell through the cracks who should never have been without a medical card.
But Gerry, There's still people falling through the cracks, people who should have a medical card, who've always had a medical card. I mean, like on call in the surgery, you're having these people coming in saying, listen, you know, my medical card's gone, what do I do? I had a woman with severe depression who came in and I said, Gerry, listen, I've just been told by the chemist you're not getting your medicines. And she said, look, I've lost the card. Now, part of the problem is she's now so depressed because she's off her medicines that she can't even get herself together to reapply for it. She sent in some of the stuff, was told part of the application wasn't filled properly. She's, you know, we're telling every patient, photocopy everything, register it when you're sending it, because otherwise you're going to be told there's a bit missing, you haven't sent it in. All of this is going on. So the problems in the centralisation process, yeah, of the medical cards are still not resolved, far from resolved.
Yeah, I accept that.
And in this plan, you're talking about increased assessing of those with medical cards, and there was some talk of yearly assessments. I mean, all of that is just going to mean that more and more people will fall through the cracks and lose their medical cards.
Well, that's not the intent. I mean, the intent is we have to have a certain amount of probity. We accept that, I think. But what we must do is make it easy for people, and the HSC have unfurled a communication strategy which may not have worked sufficiently, maybe, but, you know, we have to communicate with people as well, and people must communicate. I mean, if you get your car insurance or your house insurance form, you fill it out, you send it back. And similarly with this, there's responsibility on the person as well to come back and say, I have all my particulars to go back. I mean, you know, we can't make it, you know, like it was before.
I know, but Gerry, I don't know if you've ever seen the application form.
I fill them out every week.
Let's go back to what happened. They trotted out in the budget there was only 130 million in savings. What happened then? And they said, we're going to give free health care to children under 5. And what happened then? There was a huge backlash. I saw it myself. I wrote loads of letters for patients of mine. And it was a political backlash. And so, therefore, they had to roll back on it. And also what people said, look, people with chronic illness, people with multiple autoneuron disease, children with most appalling problems, and they're all going to lose their medical cards. And we saw it. I've had it firsthand. And then on the other hand, they said, we're going to give the kids under 5 with parents who could afford it. And it was politically unacceptable. Mm-hmm. So they've rolled back on it. And that's the reality of life. It's what's happened today.
And Priscilla, is it a case that this decision about medical probity and the original 113 figure wasn't made by people within the Department of Health? It came from Brendan Howland's department or Michael Noonan's department.
It's completely true. And Tony O'Brien said from the onset, he even wrote strong letters after the budget was announced, that he wasn't in favour of this figure and it was simply unattainable. And obviously common sense has prevailed and they've brought down the figure now. But I think at the background of it all, there's been some good points raised by both Gerry and Diona and Michael O'Keefe there as well, just about the whole administration of the system. I mean, government policy is to bring in universal healthcare by 2016. We know now at this stage that's unrealistic. They're still hoping they'll bring in free GP care by that stage. So we're really intent on ripping medical cards away from the people who most desperately need them. And then are we going to turn around in a couple of years' time and go, oh no, it's okay now that you can have them? Obviously bringing in free medical card for the entire country is going to cost money. And this is in the context of a reducing health budget. The problem is with bringing in the free GP care for under 6s, it'll probably be the second half of the year that will come in. Mm-hmm. So the 37 million figure won't be covering for the whole year. It'll mm-hmm. be for half a year. There's still negotiations to come. Will that actually come in this year? I mean, 2 years ago, the government very strongly promised and reiterated a number of times that they were bringing in free GP care for those with chronic illnesses. That did not happen. I mean, and as Dr. Duffy pointed out, these are the patients that most desperately need these medical cards, yet they're being denied them. And even though the HSE might claim that its policies haven't changed in relation to discretionary medical cards, I mean, we're hearing in the news every week, patients like Marie Fleming with advanced MS, being told to reapply for their medical card. Patients who have lifelong chronic conditions or disabilities, again, being shown to prove that they have these particular illnesses or conditions. So, I mean, there's a lot of hypocrisy there. Obviously, Jerry had a point that some years ago, discretionary medical cards, certain counties had a huge kind of a skewed figure in relation to discretionary medical cards. So that did have to be evened out, and that there should be geographic equality. However, with centralisation, I suppose, goes away that local feel, that local understanding of certain patients' needs, and obviously miscommunication is happening as well. I think what wasn't really focused on today was the fact that about this year, about 500,000 cards have already been reviewed. And I think Dr. Duffy kind of put that, that's why a lot of these cards are suddenly disappearing. Mm-hmm. There's been reviews ongoing. They're going to review, I think, the majority of the medical cards next year. So, you know, with all this talk of probity and not being as important, it's still going on in the background. They estimate that about 15,000 people could lose medical cards next year, but a lot more will obviously lose medical cards, and then you'll have the net gains then with those children who are under six. So,
and Jerry Buttermer, isn't part of the problem in getting the public to accept your under six free GP care is that no government minister is able to say what is the next stage in the free GP care plan?
Well, we're moving towards universal health insurance. The minister has published the white paper on it. We've seen the unfurling of it in terms of the budget here. And it will take time.
But none of the ministers in the department are able to say what group is next to benefit from free GP care.
Well, I'm not in the Ministry of Department of
Health. But I'm saying that is the problem, getting the public on side.
The plan is to roll out towards UHI. And I think part of it is, and I listened to the argument about universality, but surely if you take the young child who has a lot of trips needed to the doctor, isn't it better to get them into the system at a young age and have them in there so that their future health and their long-term health can benefit as a consequence, and thereby saving in the long run, as opposed to what's happening now? I mean, I hear the point you're making, and I understand the argument, but I go back to the point: is where do we want and what do we want our health system to look like? And do we want to have everything centred around the hospital and nothing to do with the primary care or with the GP? So there's a philosophical question that we as a nation have to face up to as
Mike
well.
I think that the problem here is that we can't afford it. We look at the document today, it's a rag bag in every respect. And the idea that we're going to give free GP care to kids under six when we can't even afford free care to people who are most deserving of it at the moment is not untenable. And the only reason for all of this is because it's politically good, and there's probably a voting in it. I thought we'd left all of that. We went through all these auction politics. I saw years ago when we gave the over 70s a free health GP or a free medical card. Most of them didn't want it at the time. Then they couldn't take it back from them, because when you give something to something, you can't take it back. And at this moment in time, we can't afford any of that stuff. If you look at the way the budget is shrunk today and what's coming down the tracks, this is crazy stuff.
From your point of view as a hospital consultant, what do you think of this service
plan? I think this is a document hastily put together. Because it was delayed in coming together. But the document itself is full of inaccuracies and full of it's not making sense. I mean, as the chief executive of the health service, it's a challenging time, and I think it's mission impossible. If you look at this moment to try and save €1 billion in the health system, and I know I'm in the system where you have no beds, the capacity issue in the hospitals at this moment tonight, you have kids in trolleys and chairs. In trolleys anyway, in one of the hospitals I know, you have the same in adults in hospital, trolleys and chairs tonight. It hasn't changed very much. The only problem has changed is people have forgotten about it, and the INMO, the nurses don't do the trolley count anymore.
Yeah,
but
they do.
I haven't heard them.
They're the figures that we agreed upon. They're the only figures that are now being taken by the department.
It's gone off the boil. And if you look at the savings here, I mean, we're now going to save 108 million on the Haddington Road. Where is it going to come from? No specifics here.
Well, there's a process.
You're a politician, right, and you talk a lot, but let's give the rest of us a chance.
You're doing a good job yourself, Michael.
No, I'm very amateur at this.
You're doing a good job.
And the other thing is that we have a situation where the only way Haddington Road can deliver is they're going to have compulsory redundancies. And as I mentioned of it here, about 2,000 redundancies. I can see that, even though I gather that under the agreement that can't happen, but I think it will happen. And the other issue here is pensions. We suddenly now got to pensions. Are we going to take on people's pensions? And there's some sort of it. By adopting a budget management approach, it will be possible to allocate funding about 204 million. And it goes on to say, The approach will be to, if the number of staff requiring are greater than number of pensions provided, there will be insufficient funding available. This will be kept under review. I mean, what is that? It's meaningless stuff. And you read through all of this document, there are no specifics, no concrete ideas on it. It is a document. Took a long time to produce, and in fact I can see what happened, because you had the leaking of the top ups, which gave the government a lot of time and the minister a lot of time. But no, that's true.
That's rubbish.
That is, well, rubbish.
Respect,
rubbish.
That's rubbish.
It is not. This document should have been published a while ago.
I mean, this document is not hastily put together. There is a lot of concrete actions and deliverable outcomes. They're not aspirations.
They are aspirations.
Well, if you want to call the money's allocated to primary care, if you want to call the money's allocated to organ donation, if you want to call the money to the cochlear implants and so on as being just pure cosmetic, then that's your prerogative.
But
let's be fair. Okay, look, we live in the real world.
We all do.
And I understand fully that this is a very difficult and challenging year, as Tony O'Brien and as the Minister said. We're spending $13.2 billion on health, 70% of which is on staff cost and pay, which can't be touched. Haddington Road is a process arising from the budget, which, as we all know quite well, the Department of Public Pension and Reform, Department of Taoiseach and Health, with the HSC, will come back in terms of this. So, I mean, there's lots of positives in the document. There are challenges in the document, absolutely. I'm not going to deny that.
Okay.
But what we must do, and in this, is reform and is patient safety. I mean,
we all know about patient safety. Yeah. We all know. We've had all the reform. We've seen it all over the time. We've had the HSC now. We have these new reforms going through. Come on. We've read all that. I've been in the health system for 27 years. I don't know how long you've been in the health system. You've been chairman of the health committee from this time in the Dáil. But we've heard all of this. And this document is full of holes. It is much of it has no concrete evidence in it to support it.
Okay, Priscilla, is that fair?
There are a lot of holes in this document. It is very challenging. And I mean, Tony O'Brien and the Minister themselves have both said that's going to be the most challenging year ever. But yeah, I think we do need to look very closely at the particular figures. Again, there's a lot of talk about the Haddington Road savings, 140 million next year. But again, this year, this is one of the reasons why the HSC was over budget this year, is because the Haddington Road agreement came well under. A lot of the savings that the HSC earmarks, particularly in the last 3 years, just simply don't come into the numbers. There's always a litany of excuses where, you know, various support legislation wasn't put in place in time, etc., etc. So I think we have to be quite sceptical about the amount of savings that are to be made. And the 108 million, again, that is a really significant hole.
And it says it's unspecified.
It's unspecified. And the problem is there's a certain amount that have been put aside for Haddington Road, 140 million. We know there's going to be a certain number of redundancies, well over 2,000, I think closer to 3,000. So where exactly is this going to come from? There's other savings for agency staff. So I kind of fail to see as well, like Michael, where can this come from? Is this kind of maybe a cry for help for, you know, someone else to come in and give us more money again at this stage? I think it's very realistic that there'll obviously be another bailout sought at the end of next year. But again, that a whole 108 million, it's just a bit of a mystery, really. There are still a lot of holes, as I said, in the particular budget, because there are certain savings actually that are outlined that are interesting, that I don't honestly think that they'll be able to make them, because these include savings in the area of procurement of 30 million, shared services 10 million, value for money 10 million. In the last few years, a lot of savings have been already made in those areas. They were the easy to go to areas, particularly after the cuts began. And a couple of years ago, some senior HSE officials said that there simply wasn't any more scope in these particular areas for savings. So again, I'd have to be sceptical about how they can make these.
And Ilona Duffy, as Roisin Shorthall, the former health minister, junior health minister, was saying today, you know, when you take the 619 in addition to the 400 million deficit that the department is already in, you're talking about around a billion going into 2014, and she doesn't believe. I mean, she thinks the HSE, the health service, is crumbling. It's not going to be able to function. Are the cuts going to come to frontline services?
Absolutely. I mean, time and time again, that's where they've come to. And we talk about staff costs and 70% going on pay. I mean, what everyone would love to know is how much of that staffing is actual clinical staffing. And that's really where we seem to be seeing the most cuts. And it's fine saying cut staff, but if we cut these staff, what ends up happening is we end up having to take agency staff. And they're talking about reducing the number of staff taken on, agency staff taken on to cut costs. But the reality of it is, if we don't have the clinical staff there, the service just closes. So if you don't have enough nurses in A&E, it can't function, it closes. If you haven't enough GPs out in the, you know, in GP land, more patients are referred to hospital, more GP practices close, more patients just can't get access to the services they need. And that's what's happening. We're seeing time and time again cuts to the services.
So what's the worst case scenario then, going into next year and during next year?
Well, the worst case scenario for me in as a GP, we're seeing GPs closing up shop. And you know, you hear this thing, oh, if there are more cuts, we'll see shops closing, pharmacies closing, GPs closing. That's what we're seeing. For the first year ever, we're actually seeing establishing GPs throughout the country just closing up
but
and emigrating.
But why is that alone? I mean, as we've been saying, more and more people are on medical cards. The number of medical card allocations have gone up. So GPs are getting paid. Why are they closing up shop?
Well, GPs are getting paid, but they're getting paid less for the amount of work they're having to do. And I suppose the thing is, what we're seeing is increased numbers of patients with GP with cards coming to their GPs, but actually the amount that the GP practice is earning from that workload is decreasing. So we're doing more work for less money. The issue, I suppose, in general practice is that we're different to the rest of the healthcare system. We are small businesses. So we have staff, we have nurses, we have secretaries, cleaners. We're paying rents, rates, electricity bills and everything. And those costs have not reduced, whereas the overall funding paid to the GP practice has reduced. And that's where it's now become just unworkable for many GPs.
But the perception among the public is that GPs are very well paid.
Absolutely. And when figures are released by the HSE talking about hundreds of thousands being paid to individual names, GPs, that makes for good reading, and it makes for, you know, brilliant giving out about GPs saying, well, this GP got that money. That's not where the money doesn't go to a GP, it goes to a GP practice that could have a number of doctors taking a living from that, nurses, secretaries, everything. So it's not like that. I think the other issue is, I mean, you see it, if the money was that good, we'd be seeing GPs wanting to stay in Ireland. What we're seeing is we're training GPs just like the hospital doctors, and they're emigrating. They're heading to Australia, they're heading to New Zealand, and they're heading to Canada, and they're not coming back. So we're faced, just like with the hospital system, with an absolute crisis in general practice. We're losing established GPs. We're not able to replace those who are retiring from general practice. And we are going to end up with a system like the UK, where we'll have waiting lists to see your GP. So you will ring and you'll be told, I'll see you in 3 weeks. That's the next appointment that's available. And let's not forget, that's the way it is in the UK. I have two siblings in the UK and they ring looking for a GP appointment with a sore throat and they're told it's 2 weeks. If you think it's urgent, head to your local A&E.
Priscilla,
that's coming here.
Yes, I'd just like to come in. I think she's raised some very important points there. One of the best working parts of the health service is general practice. I mean, that's because they're independent providers of healthcare. We can get a same-day service here in Ireland. In the last 3 or 4 years, GPs have faced a raft of cuts, fees under the FEMPI Act, whether or not people agree, whether, you know, that there was should have been savings there. Next year, they've been marked for 172 million more in cuts. So there's a lot of lip service from the government about investing in primary care and rolling out services there and preventative healthcare, when the reality is they're actually just stripping money. And if we're supposed to be having money follows the patient, well, why isn't money following the patient into primary care? There's so much more that they could do in relation to chronic care illness and providing supports in primary care. They need a new contract to provide that, and they also need particular resourcing. But again, that isn't happening. And it is very true, because I've interviewed a number of GPs actually who have emigrated, even a very well-established GP who just went off to Canada there recently enough. I think they're just tired of the whole system about having to fight for everything to defend their rights. And again, as we've said, some GPs actually, their waiting lists are closed. And even I rang a GP surgery a couple of weeks ago and was told I'd have to wait 2 days. And that's not long. But for me, that was quite a shock in modern day Ireland when I was told that I'd have to wait when you're used to being able to walk into a GP practice. So there is a lot of trouble there. GPs earlier this summer as well, they withdrew their support for the primary care teams. There hasn't really been much about that. And again, the both representative bodies for GPs have come out again against the free GP care for under sixes, because they've just said, A, that they're very supportive of extending free GP care, but just in the reality when other patients are getting their cards stripped away and they don't feel that the money is sufficient or that they haven't been consulted. So I mean, they're really, really unhappy. I mean, we kind of have to listen to health staff. They're the people who run the health services. And I mean, if they're that unhappy general practice at the moment and they've been earmarked for far more cuts next year, I mean, we could be facing serious issues.
Do you agree with that, Michael?
Yes, I think that's what's happening on the ground. I mean, again, in hospital practice, and I sympathise with the health system, and as in every country, because we've resources are limited and have ageing population and so on. But hospital consultant posts haven't been filled. There are significant, I think about 25% of them are idle now. I've seen jobs, really excellent consultant posts in one of the hospitals I work in. They had two candidates, both locums. One was a locum, the other was from Italy. These would be jobs in previous times, would be 20 applicants in for them. And those who are getting jobs at the moment, there's no reflection on them. They wouldn't even be shortlisted in previous times. So that's the reflection at the manpower level. At hospital level, there are serious issues. There's a morale, there's a crisis in morale in the hospitals. People are deflated in every respect. And one of the other things I cannot understand is that we used to have the National Treatment Purchase Fund. We didn't call it a new name, known as the Special Delivery Unit. And I give you an example of how mad the whole thing is. Take Waterford, for example, the Waterford Regional Hospital. They had a superb eye unit there for years. One of the top guys in the country, highly respected international, is Patrick Condon. He built up a superb unit. That unit now has been run down. And because of that, they couldn't do any. They have been doing so few elective procedures, like, for example, cataract, which is the commonest operation eye doctors do at the moment. So all of these cases have been waiting. So do you know what happens now? They're all now being done privately in Dublin and elsewhere, and they're spending 2 million to do all of these cases. That 2 million could have gone into the eye unit in Waterford. And do you know what's even worse? Most people who have cataract surgery, many elderly folk, they'll need a second eye done. So these people will never have their second eye done. So we've now got rationing going on. And this is a classical example of what's going on here, of mad thinking.
Do you accept that, Gerry? I mean, you're hearing directly from people working on the front line. Do you accept the terrible state of the health service?
Yeah, I mean, there is challenges in terms of what we're doing. You can't just take money out of a health budget and reduce the number of staff and not have any repercussion. But, I mean, the special delivery unit has reduced the number of people on trolleys. We've seen a reduction in waiting lists in certain key areas. But the key thing is, you know, I mean, we're on a path to universal health insurance. There are many vested interests in the health system. And what I and what others want to see happen is that the patient continues to be at the sole focus, at the core of what we do in the health system. And the first stepping stone is the delivery through the under-6 GP UHI. That's the beginning. The white paper will be in January. And, you know, it's a bit like turning an oil tanker on the ocean. It doesn't go on one turn. And this is a minister who's delivering on reform, who will drive reform. And yeah, there has been cuts in the FEMPIAN for different people, but we've all taken cuts no matter where we are. Yeah,
Gerry, could I come back to you on the trolleys? You know, the system now is that if you're on a trolley for too long, they find the hospital. So do you know what they've done?
They put them
sitting in chairs. Gerry, yeah, this is Michael, the reality.
You're coming,
spokesman for the minister. I'm only telling you.
You're wearing an umbrella hat.
I'm not wearing anybody else's hat on my own. I'm wearing my hat as I'm a consultant on the front line.
Be fair now.
And no, you're
not being fair.
I'm being fair to you because
Gerry,
you don't know that. Because you've mentioned trolleys.
I do.
And the other thing about the special delivery, all the other things happening at the moment, you've a whole lot of outpatients now being treated privately. Millions, 18 million being spent. That 18 million should have gone into, say, Waterford is a classical example of what should have happened. And this
are you against the creation of the hospital groups?
I think there are a whole lot of issues with the hospital groups. I think it's just another way of shifting the whole thing because it's going to create a massive amount of bureaucracy.
So you want no reform? You want the status quo to continue?
Jerry, I'm happy with reform.
You're
a political spokesperson here for the minister.
He wants to defend himself.
We can't hear you when you're all talking.
Let me talk and then
okay,
you can
go ahead, because you have all the answers. That's
I don't have all the answers, but I'm not a politician and I don't interrupt you.
So basically, let's deal in the facts.
Well, I'm dealing with the facts. People on trolleys, if they're on for too long, the hospital is fined, so they have to go on to chairs. So you've not a lot more people on chairs. That is fact. Fact about the Waterford is fact. Fact about the special delivery unit, about the money they're spending on patients treated privately is fact. This idea that children under six, this should be the last thing we should do at the moment, where we have no money. What we need to do is get honest. Say, we have no money. That's all the money I have as minister. Look, I'm doing my best. But stop promising things you can't deliver at the moment. And this idea of universal healthcare, we've got to look at that much more clearly. Because in Holland, for example, it's costing a fortune. And this country will not be able to afford it unless things change.
Gerry, Mary, who's a nurse in Dublin 14, has texted to say that Michael O'Keefe is right about trolleys. Beaumont has had over 30 people on trolleys since the 11th of November. Last Tuesday, they had 50 and it's being ignored.
The number of people on trolleys is reduced under this minister. That's the reality. And we've one singular counting mechanism for that. Look, I mean, I'm not here to tell you everything is rosy in the garden. Anything but. But what I am saying, and what I'm very clear about as a non-medic, and as somebody who's very acutely aware of what happens in the health system, who meets with people every day of the week, be it the patient, to the hospital porter, to the consultant, and all points in between. We cannot allow the situation to continue that's happening. We need to have reform of our health system, whereby we can create more efficiencies, deliver more services with the patient at the core, with a lesser amount of money to spend.
Okay.
That's the reality. Well, under Fianna Fáil, the budget quadrupled.
Well, let me make the point.
Under Fianna Fáil and Mary Harney, the budget quadrupled. And what happened? Chaos. Now we have a situation, like it or not, we have to reduce our monies. I wish we didn't have to do that. But we do, unfortunately.
Well, okay. Could I say, look, Fianna Fáil have their own spokesman. I'm not a member of any political party.
I wasn't saying that, Jerry,
because you've got to get better arguments than that. Don't use that sort of argument.
I was making the point.
Do you know, like,
I made the point that under the Fianna Fáil, the last government for 14 years, we quadrupled. It wasn't any. No. Okay, the reality is, under Fianna Fáil and Mary Harney, the health budget quadrupled.
Okay, you've made that point, Jerry.
Can I make just one more point before?
Very briefly.
Unlike Jerry, I work on the front line, Jerry. I work in the front line. I see 14,000 kids in our clinic in a year and as many adults. So don't tell me what I know. I see it firsthand. And so I don't need lectures from anybody.
I'm not lecturing at all.
All right.
I'm not lecturing at all.
I think the problem with this plan is that it is all talk. And, I mean, what can't be denied is that it's going to bring about more cuts and it's going to bring about more pain. We're already seeing the impact of it. And exactly, I have to agree with Michael. I mean, we have patients who refuse to go into hospital. I mean, one night I was on call and there were two elderly patients in the same nursing home, both needed to go into hospital and both refused, said they'd rather die in the nursing home than go into hospital. And one died that night. Now, that's a terrible state of affairs if you get to a stage where people are afraid to go into hospital. And it's mainly because they know they're going to be in a chair or a trolley. A trolley if they're lucky. And Michael's right, it's transit lounges. They're not counted as being part of the system there. And I mean, this whole document is fudging everything. I mean, it's talking about the under sixes because it's really age five and under. And it's talking about universal health care ultimately. It isn't talking about the fact that they have never come to the doctors and they've never come to the GPs to even talk about this card for the under sixes. So no one's discussed it with us. We know from stats that GPs in Ireland have 24 million consultations a year. And this introduction of this card will bring about an estimated 4 million more consultations. Now, how can that happen in a safe way without any planning, without any discussion with the GPs, without any resourcing of nurses, of extra staff into primary care? And that's the reality of it. We've already seen the chronic care packages are crumbling. I mean, they were meant to be out of role. Diabetes was meant to be around the country that we're having shared care in the community and more diabetics being looked after in a better, more formalised, more structured way, which can happen easily in primary care. But it's not going to happen because the resources aren't coming to general practice and they're not coming to primary care. And the final thing I want to say is, in this document, when we talk about value for money and everything, here is 0.86 million investment to be put into a diploma in leadership and quality in healthcare for managers and critical leaders. That's the kind of rubbish that just says it all.
Priscilla. I'd like to go back to some of the points that Michael and Jerry were making during their bit of a boxing match there earlier. Michael, it was very true, his point just about we're spending to take people off waiting lists when we by treating them privately that we could do publicly. Crumlin, for example, is spending 3 to 4 million a year sending patients to the UK for stem cell treatments and other treatments that could be provided at half the cost in Crumlin itself if they actually just got the direct funding. But Jerry was right as well that there's so much reform that is needed. And I think, have we come to the precipice now where we're actually going to critically take a look at the staff levels in the voluntary hospitals versus the public hospitals versus all the voluntary providers versus the state providers and just look at the different levels of staff there, the different levels of administration and management, and actually try and strip some of those out. There are so much protections in there to protect gold-plated pensions, gold-plated managers at the very top. I mean, managers are very important. But we really need to, at this stage, try and get much better value for money. And I mean, there are certain services around there that you might go in, you might be met by a secretary, a PA and someone else before you can get to someone in the top office, whereas you run into a public hospital and you'll see a manager there answering their own phone or a consultant doing their own phone as well. This is where we need to look at much more critically the agency 39, section 38, 39, funding, payment and obviously staffing levels as well. Because there is big savings that could be made there. There is still a lot of inefficiency happening in our health service, but again, it seems to be the wrong areas that are targeted for savings. It seems to be very hard to isolate those areas where changes could be made. Staff morale is very low, and a lot of staff have some great suggestions about saving money and implementing great innovation as well. I mean, despite all the figures and facts that we're hearing today, it's, you know, it's easy to be confused. There are actually some very good things happening in the health service that we need to support more. There was some good screening programs that started this year in diabetic retinopathy. retinopathy, yeah, and in bowel screening as well, even though it was quite disappointing there that they haven't extended the age for breast check mm-hmm. next year. So, you know, morale is low, but there are some great things happening there. And I think, you know, we have to look at those areas where savings could be made that they're not being made. And I suppose politically, Jerry, I suppose we have to come to the table and ask those difficult decisions. Certain services that are provided 24/7 in big hospitals like in cities like Cork and Dublin, do we need them all to be 24/7? I think 2014 is going to be the year where we look at these and maybe make some unpopular decisions, but decisions that could save money and allow money to be spent elsewhere.
Well, the creation of the hospital groups mm-hmm. will help to do some of that, where you have shared services, where you have a pooling of resources. But I mean, I think it's important that we put into context tonight for the listeners who are listening to us that there is a huge amount of work being done. There's more activity happening in our hospitals. The staff that work there are doing Trojan work, and we shouldn't just use words that the hospital system is crumbling and that, you know, if that morale is low. I mean, there are people going out who are tonight working in hospitals who are doing superb work, and they do it by day as well. And, you know, we should give them credit as well. I mean, and if you're listening to tonight, I think part of what we have to do is culturally how we view the hospital in terms of, as we said earlier outside, in terms of using the emergency department as the first port of call. And where I would like to see more emphasis on, and I accept it's been slow, is the unfurling of the primary care model, where we need to do that properly. And I would hope that as part of the reform agenda, that we will resource properly primary care in the lifetime of this government. I know it's been slow, and I accept that. But I mean, it's about changing that mindset about the hospital being the first port of call. I mean, I see in Cork, for example, where the Urgent Care Centre in Grána Brothar on the side of the old orthopaedic hospital has become a tremendous facility and resource in taking people away from Cork University Hospital or the Mercy Hospital. And then if you have the other areas in terms of your primary care, that can help change the policy delivery.
As Dr. Tadhg Crowley, who has tweeted tonight, and he's a regular listener to this programme, he asks, where is general practice in this plan today? It's non-existent. He says, resource it and save real money.
Yeah, only mention of GPs is the cut of 172 million.
And when they talk about money following the patient, they're talking about it only in the hospital setting. There's no mention of it following mm-hmm. them into general practice
and Michael,
or primary care.
Tony O'Brien says today the hospitals are actually going to get more money.
Well, I don't know where that's in the document or where that's going to happen. I think the hospitals are already, many of them are desperate. They don't even know what their budgets are. Some are living from hand to mouth. I know one of them in particular is probably about able to pay its staff this month because it doesn't know where the money's going to come from. As regards reform, of course, we all want reform. I mean, this is the buzzword, reform. What do I find wrong with the hospital groups? It's going to increase bureaucracy. All these hospital groups that are going to have another layer of bureaucracy on top, they're going to have 7 or 8 people running them on top of the groups itself. And each of these hospitals has a CEO. And I saw a brochure from one the other day. It's got 23 managers, 23 managers and a CEO. And then all the groups will have another layer of management. And do you know what that means? More computers, more offices, more secretaries, more everything. And that's the problem, Jerry, I have with the new rollout. And then the other issue which defies belief is Waterford. Waterford was set up as a regional hospital. It's been destroyed. All its feeder hospitals, Wexford is feeding to Dublin. Makes no sense. Wexford is only, 50 miles from Waterford, and yet it's feeding all its patients into the Vincent's in Dublin. I mean, why was that done? Was it political or otherwise? Kilkenny is the same. So Waterford now is decimated, and Waterford now has become part of Cork when it was set up, built as a regional hospital not so long ago. And so these are the issues that I have.
Yeah, but John Higgins, to be fair, is chair of that group and who worked very hard on that reconfiguration, did a very good job. And I don't agree with you that Waterford's been decimated. I think you're again missing the point. Well, Waterford now is the ability to grow independently itself and in the context of Cork. John Higgins is a very fine person.
I'm sure he is.
He did a very good job in chairing that reconfiguration. He had no vested interest. His only interest was in the quality and delivery of healthcare for the people in the catchment areas. And you know, I mean,
Hang on. I mean, I'm not questioning any aspects. I know, but I'm just saying, I don't know the man. He's a professor of obstetrics, an esteemed one in Cork.
But you did cast aspersion on the work.
I did. I cast aspersion on the Waterford Regional Hospital, which is a factual issue, Jerry. A factual issue. It's a hospital set up, built some years ago, was supposed to be the regional hospital, and you've Kilkenny and Wexford now feeding into Dublin. So Waterford has no hospitals to feed it as a regional hospital. So it's now become part of Cork University Hospital. And I've mentioned the eye unit, which is factual as well. You can check all of those if you want to. I'm not here to cast aspersions on anybody. I'm here to give you facts.
I accept the point, but I mean, let's be fair. I mean, John Higgins did a job in reconfiguration.
Okay, let's move on from John Higgins.
Nobody has any extragram of John Higgins.
To be fair, he did a good job. I think it's accepted in Tralee and, in Kerry and in Cork, the reconfiguration there. But Professor O'Keefe has some very valid points there. Waterford as well. We can't just force hospitals in particular geographic areas to fit a neat little box when we're spread out into a particular way. Cork was a cluster along with Kerry. There's obviously problems as well in Galway and Limerick when it comes to reconfiguration, that they're being overwhelmed by some of the feeder hospitals, as we've heard. So, I mean, we have to accept that there's been some mistakes made when it comes to reconfiguration, and that we have to look at maybe going back to the drawing board with some of the plans there.
Well, coming from Monaghan, what can I say?
Yes, the ultimate example of the
North East. Ultimate example, and in his day, Professor Drum told us that we were the template for the rest of the country, so that doesn't bode well if that's still in the HSE pipeline. I mean, the promise to us was that we would see services go in Monaghan only for better and safer services to be provided elsewhere. That's not what's happened. What we saw was the hospitals who were expected to take the workload become inundated, see their own cuts happen there, and then, obviously, the promises with regards to ambulance services were reversed, and you know, all it's meant is it's harder to be seen when you're sick, and it's harder to access that urgent care when you need it.
But the mistake that was made day one in the creation of HSC was that we didn't do what Michael said in terms of the middle management and some of that layer of bureaucracy to get rid of it. In fact, we didn't do it at all, and it was a political fudge that was funked by Micheál Martin et al.
Well, Bernard in Cork has texted in to say, I'm with the HSE in Cork. I went to a presentation on the new hospital trust a week ago. A lot of new managers being appointed to the health service. It's jobs for the boys and girls.
Well, it shouldn't be that.
Oh, that's the reality.
None of us want that to happen. I don't think it's going to happen like that.
He says it is happening.
Yeah, that's what's happening. A whole layer of bureaucracy.
The model of healthcare that I want to see is patient-centred, driven with the patient at the core and at the heart of it. And that's what we have to have.
But we still have a situation where, I mean, unless a manager walked in with a machine gun into hospital, to use a very blunt example, that's the only time they might be held accountable for the death of a patient in their hospital. There is still a lot of a lack of accountability for management. And if there's poorly performing managers, what happens? Are they removed? Are they fired? I mean, can we go into our hospital system like in a private company and selectively say, you're not performing, you're out, we don't need this many managers, we need better managers here, we need managers actually to be better supported because a lot of them aren't supported sufficiently. No, we can't do that. So yet again, as I said, there are certain issues again there with the appointment of managers. I mean, as we've seen even with the CRC top-up scandals there, I mean, you know, people being appointed in a variety of ways that aren't seen to be in best practice. Again, I think we really need to look critically at perhaps the even internal management appointees there, as Audrey has pointed out.
I think Priscilla's point is excellent because, I mean, the managers are all too ready to land nurses and doctors in the soup with reporting to the board, alternates in the medical council. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's making sure there are safety measures there. But there is nothing and nobody there to make management accountable for mistakes that have been made and continue to be made.
Well, the new patient safety agency will hopefully do some of that. I know it's
And what's wrong with HICWA? Why are we bringing another agency with more people and more money and more management?
I think it's important that we do give patients and that this new safety authority will act as another buffer to help.
Well, will we then get rid of HICWA? Will we amalgamate HICWA with the new agency? And there's another agency also in the HSE. Is that going to be defunct? I mean, let's put them together. We've three different... this is the other reform we thought would happen. We get rid of a lot of these quangos.
We have to.
Well, we got rid of this, but we've created all this. I'm not sure whether the net effect has been zero or whether... But here we are, another quango,
but
Jerry.
The government has gotten rid of quangos. We're doing that. And, I mean, you know, let's give credit where it's due. I know it's hard in cases to give credit, but we are giving some of the quangos.
You change the plaque on the wall, but the same amount of staff exists. Because I know I did some research a few years ago about some of the quangos that were abolished, and I asked how many staff were gone, and I was told none of them were gone. They were just actually amalgamated in, and they were in a bigger office now that had a different plaque on the wall.
Not under this government,
that actually cost money then to change the plaque and to change the stationery as well that they were using. Yeah. So,
but Gerry, this government actually promised, and James Riley promised, that there was going to be a change in this, that there was going to be a reduction in the management. We were going to see more clinical staff and less managerial staff. And unfortunately, that isn't happening.
Well, I think it's a process and work that will take time to deliver.
And how long will it take to deliver?
That's, as I say, the analogy I quote is the Titanic. You can't turn it in the ocean in one sweep. It's take a couple of turns, but we're getting there, and it's slow.
Titanic Titanic, sure.
But it's sunk.
When it happened, the Titanic, it sunk.
But I think the health service.
We better be careful here.
The health service. Yeah, we have. You're right.
We've mentioned some of them tonight.
There is. You're right, and I accept that. But this is a minister who will drive reform.
Oh, come on, Jerry.
He has a vision, Michael, for the health service.
Jerry, come on. Let's be fair. I don't accept that.
I know you don't, but I wouldn't be surprised if you didn't like him.
No, no, because I think he hasn't any vision, and I think the man has been a big disappointment. He talked the talk when he was in opposition, but he hasn't walked the walk in any way.
He's delivering on reform.
And you're here to defend him tonight. And I sympathise with you trying to defend him. I sympathise with you.
Well, he's done more in 2.5 years than the other government's parties did in 14 years.
More damage or more good?
More good.
Well, to be fair, there was a specific promise made this year that no patient would be waiting longer than a year by the end of 2013 for an outpatient appointment. At the end of September, there was over 84,000 patients waiting for over a year.
I mean, well, we now have 5,000 of orthopaedic patients coming from Galway for outpatient private appointments. We've 400 or 500 kids from Temple Street going to be seen privately. So we're doing our best to get all that done so he'll look good in the Dáil in January or February, Jerry.
And I'm not even sure where those figures come from, because one of the figures talks about in primary care setting that only 10% of referrals to physio aren't seen within a 12-week period. I mean, the physio waiting list in our area is at 7 months now. So, you know, this isn't adding up. What's in here is not what's happening on the ground. And it's a bit more like trolley watch. You know, there are different figures being bandied around.
A couple of texts to you, Ilona, about GPs. You can understand why many of our listeners aren't very sympathetic for GPs. Jaron Cork says, my heart is bleeding for the GPs of this country having to take cuts. Baha, let them join the rest of us. Liz says, neither doctors nor consultants have reduced their fees. Who has ever heard of a poor doctor? And another one says she wants to know, Ilona, what you would consider as an acceptable salary for a GP to be.
I think the reality is we don't have a salary, and perhaps that's something that we should be looking at, where we have a guaranteed income and we have the protection of that and guaranteed pensions.
Would you have a figure?
Would I have a figure? No, I wouldn't have a figure. But I will say that funding to general practice through FEMPI cuts has seen a reduction of 37%. There hasn't been a 37% drop in rents and rates and electricity or in staff costs. And that's why we're seeing the problems. And it's very easy to say, well, yes, GPs, you know, are well paid, because we're getting figures bandied about hundreds of thousands being given to individual names. That, again, I want to reiterate, is not individual pay to individual doctors. It is money going to practices to pay for all the staff and all the costs.
Michael, can you answer a question from one of our listeners? They say, all my medication is now generic, but why am I still paying €144 a month? I got many of these tablets in France for half the price.
Well, I think they shouldn't be paying €144 a month. They should be paying a fraction of that. It should be half that. So I think that's probably they're overpaying.
Any reason for
Mike,
that?
Michael is right. I mean, I don't know, but yeah, Michael, in terms of the bill that was passed, I mean, the general press referencing, that fee should come down.
Yeah.
Well, where's their patients going across the border?
It won't be cheap as in France and Northern Ireland, but it'll be far cheaper than what they paid up here to for.
Okay, a few more texts. Brendan in Dublin says, per capita, Ireland is spending as much on health as the leading countries in Europe. How is it that we have an inferior service compared to these countries? And that's when we have a more favourable demographic profile than they. Dennis in Dublin says, can anyone explain how a presumably healthy under five is entitled to a medical card, yet I've worked since 1979 and can't afford to see a doctor at times? Brian in Longford says, medical professionals just don't get it. They are too used to high incomes. They're not in touch with monetary reality. Tommy says to you, Jerry, tell Deputy Buttermer that the people have given their verdict on Fianna Fáil, to stop using the previous government. They're gone. Get a new argument. And Maurice de Vulve, who's a GP, says the cost of doing private procedures in the UK include the loss of experience and expertise to our system, as well as the loss of money to our economy. We're into the last 5 minutes of the programme, and we're going to go to Met Eireann in a minute or so, just to get an update on the awful weather that's been battering the country tonight. But just before we go, Priscilla, the HSE, I mean, is it coming to an end?
Well, we keep hearing that, but it's still going on. I think, for me, I'm more interested in what's going to happen in January when we get the divisional healthcare plans, which are, you know, what would have been known as the regional health plans, because there's usually a lot more detail in
those
plans.
What will be in those?
Well, there'll be obviously the individual hospital budgets and the individual region budgets, and obviously what's going to happen in each region and in each hospital. There might be a bit more of a clue as well, just about the particular services that will be cut. We've had a lot of outline and general national figures today, but we'll obviously get a lot more detail in those particular reports in January. So I think that's what everybody wants to hear about. Hopefully we'll have a bit more information about this massive 108 million hole as well. I mean, there's still a few big holes in this budget going into next year. And as I said, there's been an issue as well we didn't discuss tonight, just about overdrafts and hospitals. A lot of hospitals have been forced to use overdrafts. And I mean, they're being told that they're going to have to stop that and clear those next year. I'm going to find that very hard to believe when they're looking at the same budget, if not a reduced.
And just briefly, Ilona, are you dreading the publication in January of these regional plans?
Absolutely, because all that's happened before is with any of this, it's meant reduction in hospital services with the presumption that general practice will be able to take the extra workload. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing patients being told, go see your GP, get this done, get that done. If there's a delay in appointments being sent out, well, again, go see your GP. But we can only do so much and we can't do hospital work. We can only do GP work.
OK, well, just before we go, as I say, we're going to get an update on the stormy weather lashing the west and northern parts of the country. Unfortunately, it has already claimed one life, a young woman killed this evening when her car was a tree fell on her car in Mullingar. Vincent O'Shea is joining us now from Met Éireann. Vincent, how bad has it been and where has been worst affected?
Well, indeed, it's been a very tempestuous day, almost countrywide, Audrey. The winds weren't certainly not record breaking, but they were associated with what we would call a squall line, which was associated with a front which crossed the country during the afternoon. Now, it did produce a localised very heavy rain for a short while. There was some places had as much as 15 to 18 millimetres in the space of an hour and a half. So obviously that would cause flooding in such a short space of time. Now, the winds, the highest winds during the afternoon when all the trouble arose were around 60 knots. They obviously would have been probably a lot higher than that in localised areas because it was a very narrow squall line. But in the last couple of hours, about 2 hours ago, we've had a gust of 78 knots that was reported in a coastal area of West Galway.
And I mean, you're on a red alert. It's the highest weather warning that can be issued. How long is that weather warning in force?
Well, firstly, it's been in force for most of the day today. I should mention that those very strong winds at the moment are more or less confined to Connacht and Ulster. And that red alert will stay in force for the early part of the night after midnight, probably up until about 3 a.m. But everywhere and otherwise, most places, the winds should ease as the night goes on. So I think the worst of the winds should have passed by around 3 or 4 a.m. But then what we're looking at tomorrow then is much colder weather. And the next problem is we'll have widespread showers tomorrow, very frequent in the west, again, with very gusty winds, but not as bad as today. And some of those showers could contain hail, even some sleet over high ground. So particularly colder tomorrow than recent days.
OK, so just very briefly, Vincent, one of our guests is driving from Dublin to Monaghan tonight. Will she have a relatively calm journey?
Well, it won't be calm, but it'll certainly stay blustery, but the wind's nowhere as strong as they were during daytime today. So I think she should be safe enough.
Good stuff. Well, look, Vincent, thank you very much indeed for joining us tonight there, Ilona. Well, safe driving anyway. And thank you very much indeed for coming down to Dublin from Monaghan to be with us on the programme tonight, Dr. Ilona Duffy. Thanks too to Michael O'Keefe, Professor Michael O'Keefe, Deputy Jerry Buttermer, and to Priscilla Lynch. We'll be back with our final late debate of the year tomorrow night at 10 o'clock usual time. So join us for that if you can. Until then, from me and from all the team, good night.